Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Sports betting in Illinois, it's still a young industry, but it's doing well, and the governor wants a bigger share of revenue for the state. An analyst will join us to talk more about it. It's also Gambling Awareness Month in Illinois. We'll speak with an addiction specialist about the signs that someone has a problem. The primary election is just ahead in Illinois this month, but finding poll workers isn't easy. We'll hear more. And also talk about a change at the top for a public university and what a new report recommends when it comes to higher education funding. We'll introduce you to the state's Bilingual Teacher of the Year and hear more about how federal investment could help with Great Lakes shipping. Those stories and more on the way on Statewide. This is Statewide. Coming up, we'll talk sports betting in Illinois. But first, most of the goods we buy get to where they need to go on the back of a truck or train. But about 5% of cargo in the U.S. is transported over water, including the Great Lakes. Many of the ports and waterways there are in need of updating. And that's something Rust Belt leaders are hoping to do with $17 billion from the Biden administration. From Chicago, reporter Julian Heidaw has the story.
The International Port of Illinois is on the far south side of Chicago. It's a vast landscape of asphalt, hosting a beehive of forklifts, and on a late fall day, workers sort pallets of lumber fresh off of ships from Canada.
They could be going to Home Depot, Menards, they could be going to maybe a construction company.
That's Eric Varela, the port's executive director. In addition to lumber, the big ships that travel through the Great Lakes also drop off towering, loose piles of iron ore, gravel, and salt. Those goods used to mean big business, especially at this port when it opened in 1959. Now, a majority of the docks here sit vacant. Varela thinks it's because this 1,800-acre port has hardly seen any major capital improvements in decades.
I mean, you could see the condition of it over here, right?
Nearly half of the 1,000-yard-long dock is partially collapsed into the river that connects to Lake Michigan.
You cannot put a crane there or unload things safely over there, and it just kind of gets worse as you go down the dock wall here.
He's hoping to get a slice of the new federal funds earmarked for maritime infrastructure. It's not an easy case to make. A congressional report issued last spring shows the amount of domestic cargo on the Great Lakes, like coal and iron ore, has dropped by half since this port opened. DePaul University professor Joseph Schwederman researches transportation. He thinks there's a great deal of untapped potential on the Great Lakes to relieve COVID-era supply chain disruptions. He also thinks shippers need to think more creatively to bring in other commodities like machinery, electronics, and pharmaceuticals on the water.
Truck drivers are in short supply. Railroads are kind of maxed right now. So when you can ship vast quantities on a boat, you know, you simplify things greatly. Marine vessels are so fuel efficient. They're so low cost. The bulk they can handle is second to none.
Other ports along the Great Lakes, like Cleveland and Duluth, have invested millions to move those types of valuable goods. Both cities have even recently begun regularly scheduled sailings directly to Europe. That's led several other cities to compete for federal funding to build facilities to seamlessly move containers from ships onto trains and trucks. Critics say that the long-distance potential might still be limited, though. Most lakes are connected with old locks, which freeze up in the winter. At the Port of Detroit, before the sailing season ended, Captain Scott Skripchak said he's not discouraged.
It's kind of an exciting time in the Great Lakes.
He sees a renewed interest in shipping, especially if infrastructure investment can extend the season and open up new types of jobs.
We're starting to turn our attention back to the waterways. It's going to take some time. It's going to take a lot of money to do it, but the pendulum is starting to swing that way, and it's encouraging.
As the government looks forward on infrastructure, mariners here say it might also make sense to invest in inland shipping, an industry that's been keeping economies afloat for a long time. For NPR News, I'm Julian Haida on the banks of the Great Lakes Waterway.
Illinois has watched revenue from sports betting increase. Now Governor J.B. Pritzker wants a bigger chunk of that money. He's proposed raising the tax on the industry from 15% to 35% starting in the new fiscal year. To help us sort through the current landscape for betting in Illinois is Chris Altruda. He's a senior analyst for Better Collective, which runs websites called sportshandle.com, covering the sports betting industry, and usbets.com, covering casino gambling.
Off the top, it becomes less revenue for them to take home. That's first and foremost. You're more than doubling your tax rate, and it's a substantial sum of money, especially when you look at the fact that FanDuel is the top operator in this state and generates high revenue totals month after month because they have the best, they have the best hold among mobile operators. So there's a lot at stake for every operator, regardless of what their market share is in this state. It's difficult. It's a difficult pill to swallow because 15% is really on the upper end of what I would call reasonable if you're not allowed to deduct promotional credits against your gross revenue as an operator. You can get away with 20%, but it's a lot tougher. 35% without promotional deductions. So you have three states only that have 20% or higher rates without promotional deductions if Illinois does go to 35%.
I'm sure somebody's going to say, well, people are going to gamble no matter what. There's going to be plenty of money out there. Would it impact the number of gamblers as well?
No, because it's a back-end tax. It's a tax only that the operator pays. People who make, I believe the threshold in Illinois is $800, get their own separate tax form, and they have to pay taxes on winnings. But it's not dependent on the operator they use because you can acquire that $800 through any and all operators you choose to gamble with. So this is exclusively on the operator side and not the bettor side. Would it impact the amount wagered? Maybe, because an operator might be more hesitant to provide a higher volume of promotional offers to bettors. So that's something that plays into it. But at the same time, because Illinois is a top three market when it comes to sports betting handle and a clear cut number three, along with New York and New Jersey, it would be hard to see them falling off that third spot.
You used the term handle. I know not everybody is aware of that term. So maybe if you could define that for us. And then also when it comes to the state of Illinois, and we've seen projections out there, it's only been around legal here for a few years now. How is it doing overall? Is it meeting the expectations?
So a quick definition of handle is the amount people wager. If I was to place a $100 bet on, let's say, DePaul winning its next game, the $100 bet is the handle. In terms of how Illinois is performing, I could make a very easy case that I believe they're outperforming expectations because the percentage of revenue the operator keeps against the amount wagered is well above the industry standard of 7%. Now, there's another argument to that 7% standard is obsolete because the evolution of sports betting has changed. Especially in Illinois, people are betting more on parlays, which lead to a higher hold for operators, which then leads to a higher revenue total for operators, which then leads to a higher tax revenue for the state.
When this first came in, I think there were people who were wondering, you know, what would this mean for casinos? And then, of course, we have video gambling and video gambling terminals, more of them in Springfield, where I'm located, than anywhere else in the state. Have we seen any type of evidence that's, and maybe here or other places, where sports betting sort of cannibalizes the rest of the gaming industry?
No. Sports betting is an add-on in its very general sense. There were concerns in the sausage-making process that FanDuel and DraftKings, and this goes back to as far back as 2014 to 2016 era, when Lisa Madigan was Attorney General and they had to provide a ruling on daily fantasy sports because there was a gray area. And during that time, FanDuel and DraftKings operated in the state without a definitive legal ruling. When it came down that daily fantasy sports were illegal, then you get to the sausage making process of sports wagering. What Neil Bloom, who was the chairman of Rush Street and a majority stakeholder in Rivers, wanted what was called a penalty box provision in which an online only operator would have to wait 18 months until after the first casino had mobile wagering available. But what happened was, due to the pandemic, everything got thrown asunder. And what DraftKings and FanDuel both did was enter the state through existing casinos. And in the case of FanDuel, racetracks. FanDuel came in originally with Paradise Casino in Peoria, but their eventual goal was to always build a racino at Fairmount Park, which they has admittedly gone slower than expected. DraftKings in turn came in through Casino Queen in East St. Louis. And as long as you border states that don't have sports wagering yet, which is true in Illinois because you have Missouri to the west and Wisconsin to the north, you're not ever going to fully cannibalize casino revenue when it comes to sports betting, because you're going to have people coming in from out of states to bet retail. They're also going to eventually put the app on their phone, so when they cross state lines, then they'll do mobile betting. And because those mobile bets have to be placed in the state, you're still getting that tax revenue always flowing into the state. You can make an argument that maybe there's a little bit of cannibalization in terms of overall casino revenue, but that's a little harder to discern, especially also when you look at the fact that Illinois is doing what I call Casino 2.0 with this massive expansion that includes downtown Chicago, which includes Danville, which includes Waukegan, and all those places.
The Illinois is not necessarily done with expanding gambling. There's more pieces of legislation that are up for consideration right now. One of those has to do with legalizing casino internet gaming. You mentioned fantasy sports. Walk us through what those would do and how they might play into this idea of raising the sports betting tax.
Internet casino gaming tax would be an interesting legislative battle in Illinois, because it is the state that has the most extensive network of video gaming terminals in the country. And the amount of revenue that those machines generate, both in terms of state tax revenue, which I believe was north of $830 million last year, and even local revenue, which I believe is something to the effect of $140 million based on the, I believe it's a 6-to-1 split. But those machines are lifelines to local communities in terms of tax revenue. It extends further because most are at bars and taverns and VFWs. So you have the food and service industry, you have bars and taverns who are all backing this. It's not unreasonable for those bars, taverns, and service industries to believe that there would be some cannibalization on the VGT front, because one, it's on your phone, it's readily available, and there would be 3 online casino brands for every casino license.
Where does it all go from here? I mean, I'm in Springfield, and like I said, I'm seeing a lot of video gambling terminals. Those have been out there for quite a while. We're seeing this expansion among casinos. We've seen sports betting come on. Is there a saturation point, though, when it comes to the state and the revenue that can be received from this? Is there a point where we're getting to that saturation level?
I think the funny thing about Illinois is that there are still certain aspects where there's room for notable growth. Having only 8 mobile operators at this point, I believe a critical mass, I believe in most states is 11 or 12. You look at New York, which is the top marketplace in the country, it has 9. And then you look at a place like Ohio, which has, I believe, 20. And Ohio does roughly 70% of the handle that Illinois does, despite the populations being somewhat more comparable. You look at video gaming terminals, they're still not in Chicago. But each aspect of gaming in this state still has a notable amount of runway left to go with.
Well, going back to the governor's tax proposal, raising the sports betting tax from 15 to 35%, not asking you to be a legislative expert on this, but do you think the governor can get this plan through the General Assembly?
In some respects, Governor Pritzker has the capital to do this, because he is a key reason why mobile sports betting took off faster than expected in Illinois. Because there was an in-person registration provision in the law he signed, that would have gone a lot slower. But because of the pandemic, and also because DraftKings and FanDuel entered the state, there was no way to get people to casinos or to racetracks. And he suspended that in-person provision repeatedly during the pandemic. I believe when you count all of them, I believe it was either 10 or 11 times, these companies would not be as far along in terms of database signups, revenue, and even contributing tax revenue to the state had they had to sit the full 18 months and have people come to the casinos and register before having access to mobile betting. So I think at the end of the day, there'll be some pushback to it, but I also think he will get his way and get this right. I think one of the things that made the state think that they can do this is the fact that operators are winning so much more than expected. And a lot of that is because of the evolution in how people are betting. And in this state, it's one of the forerunners that parlay wagering has become a very big deal. This year, roughly 29% of the handle, and it was $11.6 billion worth of wagers in the 2023 calendar year. About 29% of that was on parlay bets. So in some respects, it's understandable that the state wants a cut of that unexpected gain. People are essentially, what they're doing is essentially turning it into a lottery ticket in that you will construct a parlay, which in this, to define it is, you put multiple legs together and all of them have to win in order to collect. So for example, we'll go back to the DePaul game. If I bet on DePaul to win, and I also bet the under on that game and I put them together, both DePaul winning and the under have to hit in order for me to win that wager. And a very large portion of them are doing it with disposable income, whether it's a $1 bet, a $5 bet, or even a $10 bet. Until the mindset of the bettor changes that I lost $10, as opposed to what looks to be the current mindset of I came one win away from winning maybe $80, you're going to continue to see that operator revenue be at an increased level compared to what was originally planned when during the legislative process.
Chris Altruda is a senior analyst for Bettor Collective, which operates website sportshandle.com that covers the sports betting industry and the site sportshandle.com covering casinos. Governor Pritzker announced a plan to raise the sports betting tax in Illinois during his recent budget address. This is Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. According to a State of Illinois assessment, nearly 4% of Illinoisans are estimated to have a gambling problem. Nearly 8% are at risk of developing one. Maureen McKinney recently interviewed Jim Scarpace, who is the chief clinical officer at the Gateway Foundation, which provides treatment for addiction problems, including gambling. This is also Gambling Awareness Month in the state.
We're in a time now where access to gambling platforms online are greater than they've ever been. During the Super Bowl of this year, I think there were three or four commercials specifically around sports betting. But in addition to that, you know, even in this at the state level now, our lottery system is virtual and online. So you can place bets virtually for the games that people used to historically play at gas stations like Lotto or Mega Millions or Powerball. Even instant tickets are online. I think all that being said, many people can manage that. We know that just like we know substance use disorder. You know, there are people that, for example, drink alcohol and can manage their alcohol use, but there is a percentage of the population who suffer from a gambling disorder. For individuals who suffer from this disease, it leads to devastating consequences, not only for them, but for their families, for their careers, for their interactions in the community. And as we really want to help individuals that fall into that gambling disorder situation or meet the criteria for what we would call a gambling disorder, get the help and treatment they need to achieve recovery. Our stance is more to make people aware of the risk of gambling disorder, understanding it to be what we would call a process addiction that impacts the brain and really can change the brain's physiology. I think there's many studies that we've seen over the last few years that actually can map the parts of the brain now that are impacted by gambling disorder. Specifically for us, those are things like the prefrontal cortex, which manages problem solving and decision making, and the limbic system, which is the pleasure center of the brain. And that's really where gambling disorder tends to activate similar to other substance use disorders. I think the difference with gambling, unlike substance use disorders, where you're putting a substance in your system and then eventually over time or in treatment, that substance can be discontinued or eventually comes out of the body. Gambling being a process addiction doesn't follow those same principles. So the more someone with a gambling disorder has access to resources that might trigger that gambling disorder, like online sports betting or really any kind of access to gambling in the community, the harder it is going to be for them to manage the issues that come with the disorder.
What are the signs that someone has an unhealthy relationship with gambling?
I think there's a few very important signs. One of them is to be unable to stop gambling on their own, despite negative consequences. For most people, for example, you know, if they lost a substantial amount of money on a bet or, you know, went to a casino and lost some money, that would really be a negative reinforcement for them. And most people would kind of start to manage, you know, their relationship with gambling differently. But someone with a gambling disorder, that's very challenging to do. And that one loss turns into, well, maybe I'll win next time. And it's continuing to engage in that same behavior despite negative consequences and unable to be able to stop the behavior of gambling or the process of gambling on their own. The other piece is to continue to, for lack of a better term, up the stakes, so to speak, to engage in more risky gambling where there's more risk for loss of money, higher stakes gambling where the odds are higher, again, hoping to generate that win. And with that, I think with gambling disorder, one of the important things to know, it's not even about winning or losing. It's the emphasis on waiting for the possibility that I might win. As that roulette wheel spinning, for example, the thought that, oh my gosh, it could land on my number really creates that high, if you will, more so than if someone wins or loses. So the anticipation of the outcome and the constant need for that anticipation to occur causes them to gamble more and more is another risk area to pay attention to.
What should loved ones or friends do if they believe someone has the disorder?
Well, first of all, the most important thing to know is that if you are someone with this disorder, it can feel overwhelming. It could feel like there's nothing that I can do to change this. And we know that's the furthest from the truth. So if you're someone who's struggling with what you believe may be a gambling disorder, the first step is to reach out and get an assessment. Allow us to help you figure out what treatment options may be available to you. If you're a family member who's worried about your loved one, talk to them. Let them know that, you know, treatment's available. We know that gambling is not an isolated problem. It tends to be related at times to other mental health issues like depression and anxiety. It's not uncommon for many people that suffer from problem gambling to also have a substance use disorder, like an alcohol use disorder, for example. So at Gateway, we're able to treat the person holistically and really address all of these components. So not only gambling, but mental health and substance use disorders that may be related to the problem gambling. If you're a family member, don't blame the person. We wouldn't blame them for other medical conditions. And gambling disorders is an addiction, an illness that affects the brain, just like substance use disorder. And it can be treated. And at Gateway, the most important thing to know is we've developed over the last 10 years specialized programs to treat problem gambling and gambling disorder. We, for example, have a virtual gambling treatment program that's available to individuals so that we can meet clients where they're at. We also have the ability to assess at all of our treatment centers problem gambling and help people link to the right services to meet their needs. Each person's individual needs and services around gambling, again, whether or not there's an additional substance use disorder or mental health disorder that needs to be treated are taken into account at Gateway. And we really want to develop an individualized treatment plan to meet the person where they're at. We have centers all across Illinois. So our goal is to really help people identify their recovery goals, develop a plan to address those goals, and put services in place to meet their needs.
Why is it a problem to gamble for some people, but not others.
Similar to substance use disorder, one of the things we know about gambling disorder, just like we've known about substance use disorder since the 1950s, believe it or not, when the American Medical Association put out their first article around alcohol use disorder being a disease of the brain, gambling disorder impacts the same areas of the brain as substance use disorder. Those disorders have a strong genetic predisposition, meaning family history plays a part in being at risk for problem gambling or gambling disorder, the same way it plays a part in depressive disorders, in substance use disorders. So individuals who have that genetic predisposition, or what we would call an addiction pathway in their brain, for many of those individuals, that pathway is there at birth. And it's activated by, in a substance use disorder, for example, access to the substance, but in a gambling disorder, it's activated by making that first bet or engaging in gambling behavior for the first time, and it activates that addiction pathway. And if you do not have that addiction pathway from a genetic predisposition standpoint, you are able to manage both alcohol use, for example, gambling, and other issues in a way that doesn't have negative consequences on your life. But for individuals who do have that genetic predisposition, the pathway is activated the first time they engage in that behavior. And so it's hard for someone with a gambling disorder, the same way it's hard for someone with an alcohol use disorder. People around them may be able to manage those behaviors okay, but they're not able to. And so there's a lot of shame and stigma associated with that. But again, knowing it's a medical condition, we really want to break down those barriers associated with shame and stigma, have people come forward and ask for help, and let them know that not only is treatment possible, but it happens every day to thousands of people who are in treatment with us, and that there's hope for them.
Anecdotally, or actually if you've tracked it, has there been an increase in people seeking gambling treatment through Gateway since the increase in Illinois gambling options?
Yes, I would say that over the last few years, we have seen an increase in problem gambling and individuals and families reaching out for help to try and address this disorder. In addition to individuals coming forward with a substance use disorder, for example, that are getting treatment in our facilities, that also in the course of that treatment talk about their issues with problem gambling. So one of the things we've done is, for any individual who comes in, even with a mental health or substance use disorder, where gambling may not be what's discussed up front as a need, we do a thorough assessment in that area. And what we find is many individuals with a substance use disorder or a mental health disorder have issues with problem gambling or may have a gambling disorder. So continuing to engage in that behavior if you have a gambling disorder and if that part of your brain is activated as a result of the gambling disorder, you need to engage in more of that behavior over time in order to activate that pleasure center at the same level that you activated it initially. So what that means is I may start out with what I deem as harmless gambling, but then it escalates over time as a result of having a gambling disorder, where I put myself in more high risk situations around gambling, where I have more at stake and more to lose. The other piece that we know from the science is that individuals with a gambling disorder are also more likely to be at risk for suicide because of the increased risk of depressive disorder as a result of the gambling experience and being in high-risk situations and losing not only money, but possibly their careers, their families, their homes. The risks associated with problem gambling and gambling disorder are not just about losing money or losing relationships. It also increases your risk for substance use disorder, suicidal ideations, and major depressive disorder. And know that that hope piece is so important, because as much as this feels overwhelming, as much as this feels like this is who I am and it can't be changed, that's just not true. And we've seen thousands of people recover from gambling disorder, as well as mental health and substance use disorders. And we really want to help families and individuals get the services they need so that that can be a reality for them.
Jim Scarpace is Chief Clinical Officer at the Gateway Foundation. He spoke with Maureen McKinney. You can find out more about what Gateway does and how to get an assessment of whether someone has a gambling addiction. That information at our show website. New research may shed light on a famed prehistoric site. Will Bauer has more on the latest Cahokia Mounds mapping effort.
St. Louis University and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency are teaming up to make the authoritative map of the Native American site. About 1,000 years ago, more than 10,000 people called the mounds home. While the site has been well studied over the years, different academic research has come up with slightly different data. You may wonder why NGA, a division of the Department of Defense, is involved in the research. To ensure accuracy. That's according to NGA surveyor Craig Ackerman, who says that NGA can also share their tradecraft with their friends in academia.
Showing them our techniques and how it can apply to their data sets, that just benefits everybody.
To gather the data, the researchers are flying drones equipped with light detection and ranging technology. The final product will be a 3D map. I'm Will Bauer.
Election officials say the stakes couldn't be higher to find poll workers as we head into a presidential election, but low pay and long hours can make it a challenging position to fill, meaning they need to find new ways to recruit tens of thousands of people to staff the polls ahead of the March 19th primary. As part of the Democracy Solutions Project, Tessa Weinberg with WBEZ reports on the search for poll workers.
At the Cook County Elections Operations Center in Cicero, rows of large metal boxes containing essential voting equipment sit at the ready. Ed Michalowski is the Cook County Deputy Clerk of Elections. For Election Day, he says there are 1,430 of those boxes, to be exact.
To me, it always reminds me of the Indiana Jones first movie when they're going with the Ark of the Covenant and the warehouse keeps going and going and going.
Each of those boxes full of election equipment will be sent to a precinct in the suburbs. And at each precinct, ideally, there would be 5 election judges who are trained on how to use the equipment to help voters cast their ballot. That means the county needs at least 7,150 election judges for those sites.
It's pretty daunting when you look at it.
But this year, Michalowski estimates they won't reach that goal.
We're probably going to be over 6,000 at the end of the day, which will put us in a position where we'll have at least 3 people in every precinct, which is manageable, not perfect, but manageable.
Finding enough poll workers is a challenge for election officials across the country, and even they acknowledge it's a tough job. Here's Chicago Board of Elections spokesman Max Bever.
It's long hours. It's not much pay for those long hours. And you are at the center of what can be a very politically fraught day.
But it's an essential job, too.
The way the law is written, election judges are required to be that heart of the democratic process. And when we can't get enough judges, election day doesn't run as smoothly.
To boost the ranks of poll workers, some election authorities are increasing pay. This year, a Cook County polling place technician will make $400 for the day, a $15 pay bump. And election authorities have had to get creative and push for veterans and students to help chip in. In the last 3 elections held in Chicago, Bever says nearly 20% of the election judge workforce were high school or college-age students. And election officials try to ensure hands-on training helps demystify the process for poll workers. On a recent Wednesday, Cook County poll workers were being trained on the ins and outs of the voting process.
And remember to also write the voter's name on your envelope, okay? And this is a provisional ballot envelope.
LaShawn Hatchett is a lead election judge trainer. She remembers feeling hesitant the first time she worked the polls more than a decade ago. She likes to remind new poll workers.
Don't be worried about memorizing anything here today. Everything is in the manual here.
Learning the process helped her see how her vote counts.
The more you know about it, the less you fear it. When I did become an election judge, you did see the other side of voting completely. I mean, it quelled all of the, not fears, but concerns that people may have with the security of it.
And it helps her feel like she's giving back, too.
It is so much worth it. You're serving your community. You really are.
It's the same sense of civic duty that spurred people at the Chinatown Public Library to approach Jane Lau to sign up to help.
Election judges, okay? The job is challenging, but it's really rewarding.
Lau works for the Chicago Board of Elections and focuses on outreach in the Chinese community. She's trying to recruit poll workers who are bilingual to help serve the hundreds of precincts that qualify for language assistance.
He's filling out the form to apply to serve as the judge of election on election day, and he speaks Mandarin. It's one of the Chinese dialects.
Lau does outreach like this year-round. Word of mouth is important, and her pitch is simple.
I mean, when you hear people sign up as election judges, and then they say, okay, it's the civic duty, and then that's it. There you go.
While most poll workers are only giving a few days of their time, Michalowski says it's work that couldn't be more essential.
We need help, real help, to prop up democracy.
Michael Askey says election judges are the frontline forces that help beat back misinformation and false narratives from taking root at the ballot box. Tessa Weinberg, WBEZ News.
Still on the way, a change at the top of one of Illinois' public universities. This is Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A Monmouth Roseville teacher in Western Illinois is the State Board of Education's Bilingual Teacher of the Year. Jane Carlson tells us about her work in a community that is becoming increasingly diverse.
Sarah Mendez always knew she wanted to be a teacher, but figuring out what kind of teacher took more time. As the daughter of an immigrant, the choice eventually became clear.
My father immigrated from Mexico when he was younger, and my mother was born here, and I was raised always around people from other backgrounds. And I really noticed how education made a difference for people who were trying to make their lives better.
So Mendez decided she wanted to be a teacher who helps kids who have arrived in a new country make their way. And she does just that inside her classroom in Roseville, in a rural school district where nearly one in five students is an English language learner.
This is an eighth grade English language development class, and we follow the same curriculum as a regular all native English speaker English classroom would, but usually at a little slower pace, and we go a little more in depth.
That means there's more vocabulary, more writing, and just more practice to help the students learn English.
Which is really hard to do simultaneously alongside learning eighth grade math and social studies and science. When you don't know enough English, we need to help you get those skills up to where you can be successful across the board.
When Mendez first started teaching in the district 15 years ago, she was one of three bilingual educators, and she had fewer than a dozen students. All were Spanish speakers, and they weren't what the district calls newcomers. They had intermediate language skills. That has changed in Monmouth Roseville.
Now we have this huge, amazing population of almost 400 students, 25 languages more, 20 birth countries, just all over the world. We have all sorts of different kinds of people, and that has really just, wow, just contributed so much to our community.
Mendez says she tries to find ways to help students from the Congo to Mali treasure where they're from, such as putting on a cultural program every year where students can explore their heritage. Amy Freetag is Director of Multilingual Learners at Monmouth Roseville. She leads a team of 20 teachers working with English learners at all grade levels. She says just since winter break this year, the district has welcomed new students and families from Guatemala, Mexico, Guinea, Malaysia, and Yemen who speak languages including Spanish, French, and Arabic.
I feel like our entire district is so welcoming and excited. We get a new language or we get connection with a new country and everyone's trying to learn as much as they can about that language or that country.
Freetag says they've seen an uptick of new English language learners since the pandemic. And while the majority of immigrants and refugees are coming to the area to work at the Smithfield Foods plant in Monmouth, others come because they already know people there. The teacher's work is not without challenges. Freetag says in addition to language barriers, many students have gaps in their education. She says Mendez has done extra training to teach foundational English skills to students who arrive at Monmouth Roseville with those gaps in their education, or who aren't starting school in the U.S. until 7th or 8th grade.
Even as an 8th grade teacher, she's done all of the training similar to what our elementary teachers have done. And since she has taught in elementary and in junior high, she just has the widest repertoire of skills to be able to meet students exactly where they are, which is exactly what you need in order to teach English learners.
And she says Mendez is the most devoted teacher she's ever met. Mendez says her job is kind of like giving students training wheels and also getting them out of their comfort zone. And with those newcomers, there's often what the teachers call a silent period as they're getting acclimated. But with patience, devotion, and guidance, there are breakthroughs, success stories, and joy in Ms. Mendez's classroom.
You spend all this time just talking to them and helping them figure out how things work and where to go. And then one day they say, "Can I please go to the bathroom?" And you're like, "It's a full sentence. Oh my gosh, I'm so proud of you." And that's like the goal, right? It's like just keep helping them, keep supporting them until they have those aha moments and really are able to stand on their own.
The state superintendent of schools surprised Mendez with her award in a Zoom call. She joins a cohort of 15 teachers across the state who are honored this year for their extraordinary contributions. I'm Jane Carlson.
The woman who's expected to serve as Western Illinois University's interim president is ready to hit the ground running, and the school's departing president says the decision to leave was entirely his own. Rich Egger spoke with both of them and has this report.
First, let's hear from Dr. Christy Mindrup. Pending approval from Western's Board of Trustees, she'll become interim president on April 1st. Mindrup began her career at Western in 1997 and has worked her way up through the ranks at the Quad Cities campus.
My first role was, I think the classification was called Clerk 3, and my assignment was to answer the phones on nights and weekends in our building.
Mindrup says her responsibilities grew as that campus grew. Most recently, she's been vice president of Quad Cities Campus Operations. Mindrup says while working on her master's degree at Western, a faculty member inspired her to pursue a PhD, which opened the doors to working in administration.
You know, I think my career and my education as a result of my time at Western Illinois University is what our university is all about, is just imagining new possibilities for students, to put them in a position where they can aspire, where they can think about their dreams and start to imagine themselves in new ways that they hadn't thought about before.
Mindrup had not thought much before about the idea of one day becoming a university president, and she has not thought about whether she'd like to be more than an interim president.
If I'm honest, this wasn't on my bingo card in the first place, so I haven't had quite time to absorb thinking about the long term after, but the university has my full commitment for whatever time frame that I'll be appointed to this interim position.
She says the board approached her about serving as interim president. She did not have to think much about her response.
When there is an opportunity presented to you, particularly at an important juncture for a university that you care so deeply about, you say yes to the opportunity.
Mindrup has worked across many different areas at Western, which gives her an opportunity to view the institution from a variety of perspectives. Come April 1st, she would be focusing on Western's fiscal sustainability and scalability for the things the university wants to accomplish. She also wants to create an environment for students, faculty, staff, and community members that promotes a culture of kindness that allows everyone to thrive together. In addition, she plans to be engaged in the Macomb and Moline communities and beyond. While she'll be making frequent trips to Macomb, Dr. Guiyu Huang will be departing from the area. He's been Western's president for a bit more than 3 years and says he's the one who chose to leave at this time.
There's no perfect timing, right? It's just a sensitive time. You leave in the middle of the semester, not at the end of it, right? And they create a perception that it may not be accurate. Once you make up your mind, you know, there is no point in procrastinating, right? Wait another day, another month.
And the decision is entirely yours? No one suggested maybe it was time for you to leave?
No one, entirely mine, 100%.
Huang says his wife has been teaching in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, forcing her to live in two places for a while before she left Macomb and moved there. He will soon head there, too, to be with his family. Huang believes Western is in a good place currently, with increases in international student enrollment, pay raises for faculty and staff, and the creation of an anti-racism task force. He acknowledges enrollment dropped this year, but he believes Western will turn it around.
We have a recruitment plan, retention plan. A lot of ideas have been implemented or acted on. I expect to see certain positive progress in the next few years.
As for his future plans, Huang wants to finish work on a book and he might do some consulting. But after a 41-year career in education, he also wants to relax for a while and enjoy free time with his family. Rich Egger reporting.
In 2017, Illinois changed how it funded K-12 education. Now a state commission released its recommendations on how Illinois could more equitably fund public universities, too. Peter Medlin spoke with a commission member, Robin Staines, about what it could mean for students.
We have done some hard work looking at early childhood at K-12, and when you think about it, it just doesn't make sense to really be thoughtful about what should we be spending in early childhood to get things right for our kids. What should we be spending in K-12 to make sure that our kids are really ready for college and career? And then to not look at that last piece doesn't make sense. But I think there's some other more pressing reasons as well. We have had a huge fall off in enrollment. And one of the reasons is clearly affordability. So we're down over 7%. I mean, hundreds of thousands of students down. Funding was erratic and has gone down, and that has driven up tuition costs. And so we've just got a perfect storm of challenges.
And to highlight that affordability point, the report mentions some historical context about how there was an analysis that showed that from 2000 to 2020, that state investment in colleges and universities in Illinois dropped by 46%, and that's inflation adjusted. How has that impacted Illinois students over the past couple decades?
When state appropriations and support for universities goes down, tuition goes up. And the second is, as those students get to those universities, you want to make sure they've got the supports and the services those students need to be successful. If we learned anything from K-12, it's that not every student requires the same support. It may cost more. They're the first time goers, the first generation goers. If they're English language learners, if they are parents, if they've got housing instability, all of that got factored in. And we've come up with what we think is a credible way for the state to look at it and say, okay, here's what it costs. And here's how do you adjust that adequacy target based on your student population and the type of programs and the mission that your university has, so that we can calculate for every university, here's what you ought to be spending. Now that we know that, how much do you have available? Can you reasonably expect in tuition, fees, et cetera? And then what's that gap? And then based on who's furthest from that, who's got the biggest gap, as we get new dollars, how do we spend those dollars so that we are helping the institutions that are furthest from adequacy catch up the fastest?
How different is that system and that formula compared with the way that we do things now?
Is very different than what we currently do. So the current way that we fund higher education is, I don't really have a good word for it. It is idiosyncratic and it is very individualized. So every institution essentially comes to the General Assembly and says, here's what we need. So there isn't a formula per se. So what we typically do is just, well, how much more do we have? How much can we afford to maybe send their way? And then we sort of give everybody at this point now an equal amount. You saw the governor's proposal this year is an across the board increase of 2%. That, as you can imagine, is equal, but not necessarily equitable.
Can you give folks just a few examples of what kind of factors we are weighing into this formula?
The first thing is what you care most about is what does it cost to provide instruction and student services, extracurriculars, athletics, what are those additional cost centers, then there are particular mission activities. You've got some Research 1 institutions, Research 2, Research 3. There are some that have strong performing arts. What are those missions? And then there's operational. So you factor all that together. We've got ways of calculating all of that.
Do we know which Illinois institutions are the most inadequately funded according to the formula?
Yes. If you read the report, it does list and say, according to this proposal, and with making a whole series of assumptions, all of which I'm sure will be discussed and adjusted further. University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is the closest to fully funded. Nobody's fully funded, by the way. There is more money required for everybody. And I believe the institution that's actually the furthest from adequacy, the way the formula is done, is Northeastern Illinois University. And then you've got a range in between there. The furthest from funding NEIU is only at about 40% funded. So we've got some real work to do to make sure that everybody's got what they need to keep kids successful.
To meet the goals that we have for the report, how much would we need to increase state investment over the next, again, 10 to 15 years?
I would say if we really wanted to do this and do this well and do it in a way that allowed all universities to thrive as quickly and as powerfully as possible, we would want to be investing as a state no less than $100 to $135 million new dollars a year for the next 10 to 15 years. That's a lot. And that's a lot compared to the increases that we've been getting in the last few years. But if we could find our way to get to $100 to $135 million, I think we could do extraordinary things for our students and for our state.
Are you confident that we could do it?
Depends, I think, on what the financial world looks like. I mean, I'm well aware that we are having this conversation when we're in a lean budget year. So I think it depends in part on what happens more globally with Illinois finances. But we're one of a handful of states that has revenue of over $1 trillion. And the question is, how do we want to invest that? What are our priorities? And it sure seems like this is a really significant one that pays enormous dividends to all involved, including the state and the state coffers. And it becomes hopefully one of those virtuous circles. We invest here and we're going to get that back in multiples.
That's Robin Staines with the Illinois Commission on Equitable Public University Funding, talking with Peter Medlin about the commission's new report. We're out of time for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Don't forget to join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.